This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose.
Are you a little sick of Christmas music? Don't worry, so are we.
Yes, I'm digging you. Yes, I'm digging you.
Join us for a holiday music party featuring absolutely no holiday music. We've got soul, we've got jazz, rockabilly, Indian brass, and alpendub. No rules today, just good music. That's ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. I love the holiday season, but a certain kind of crappy, happy music is inescapable, like chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Parties, shopping malls, street corners, school auditoriums, familiar melodies that might have sounded really sweet a month ago or 40 years ago, are downright oppressive by now. Music can take us to a good place or a bad place faster than any other art form. So, in this festive season, we wanted to share with you some music that is festive, but distinctly not seasonal. And what better place to start than the beach on a hot summer day? A couple of years ago, we spent the day at Coney Island with the indie rockers They Might Be Giants. We hung out on the sand, and then they set up their instruments at something called the Coney Island Museum, not far away.
Hey, fellas.
Okay, so are we ready? Are we ready now? Shall we record it?
What are we going to hear first?
This first song is entitled Idlewild, and it's kind of a dream of a perfect day in New York City sometime in the past.
It's all yours.
Sideshow at Steeplechase Bar. Test your strength, guess your weight. La la la, la la la, la la la, la la la. Take a trip in a sky ride.
They Might Be Giants performing Idlewild. That was only one of the tunes they recorded that day. Here now is one of their classic nonsense songs called Boat of Car.
Daddy sang bass. Daddy sang bass.
I took my boat for a car.
took that car for a ride. I was trying to get somewhere, but now I'm following the traces of your fingernails that run along the windshield on the boat up car.
Daddy sang bass.
Traces of your fingernails that run along the windshield on the boat up car. On the boat up.
They might be giants doing boat of car on a blisteringly hot day at Coney Island. You can't get any less Christmassy than that, can you? Unless maybe it's Indian musicians who've been stealing a trick from the British Army, brass bands. Rob Weisberg explains.
Overheard on that smart TV show Inside the Actor's Studio, host James Lipton, guest Sir Ian McKellen.
Ian, what turns you on?
A brass band gets me going. Ooh.
Well, brass bands are popular in England to this day. They caught on during the Industrial Revolution, spurred by improvements in the design of brass instruments. The word brass is a bit of a misnomer, because in some brass traditions, woodwinds are included. But the main thing is, these are bands that are built on blowing and marching. And there was a veritable boom in England. By the end of the 19th century, there were over 40,000 amateur brass bands, and the military brought their own brass overseas. Places like Tonga in the South Pacific and Ghana in West Africa. Remember the wedding band from Mirinair's film Monsoon Wedding?
When the British went back in England, they left brass band.
Hamid Khan Kawa is the director of Jaipur Kawa Brass Band, kind of an all-star touring band from Rajasthan in North India.
For us, it's a symbol of the love, symbol of the happiness. Like when baby is born, we play brass band. When there is something very happy, something festival, we play also brass band.
And especially for weddings.
There is no marriage if there is no brass band.
There is a procession through the streets at every traditional wedding, and the band is the centerpiece. Most towns and cities in India have a number of bands competing for the wedding business. They can offer lineups of anywhere from 8 to 50 musicians. The main instruments are typically clarinet, trumpets, baritone horns, and percussion. How did a military band end up playing a wedding? Frank London, trumpeter and keyboardist with the Klezmatics, also leads a klezmer brass band. He's a self-styled brass band scholar, and he has a few theories.
Brass band instruments are portable. They're loud. It's very impressive. It's very regal. It draws attention, and it's mobile.
And then there are the uniforms. Military uniforms command respect. And though they're not military bands, Indian brass bands wear military-style uniforms. Impressive uniforms are a must for wedding bands. Typically, the groom's family pays for the wedding procession, and the family wants to show off what it can afford. The bigger the band, the louder the band, the better dressed, the better the groom's family looks. During the colonial era, brass bands mainly catered to Indian nobility. After independence in 1947, village bands started forming all over India, playing regional folk songs and lots of Bollywood movie songs. This is a Bollywood classic, Piya To Ab To Aaja, sung by Asha Bhosle. And now a brass version by Shyam Brass Band. Then there are a few odd songs that just happen, one way or another, to have become part of the standard repertoire. Even playing tequila, Indian brass bands sound Indian.
And partially, I think, It's because the Indian idea of music is really antithetical to the Western idea.
Frank London.
Western military band music is very kind of a vertical music. It's a vertical harmonic progression. And you have like, bum beep, beep, bum beep, bum beep, bum beep, bum bum bum, ba da 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 da, you know, and this whole kind of thing. Whereas Indian music is more of a linear, what they call homophony, which means one melody line. So in a contemporary Indian brass band, you'll hear, it's more call and response and homophony. So you'll hear the clarinet go, and then the whole band go, they're all playing unison, which is very different from a tuba and trombones going boom chick, boom chick, boom chick.
In a twist on colonial era roles, Indian emigres to the UK brought their love of brass bands with them. This is Bollywood Brass Band, based in London, a favorite wedding band for Indian families in the UK. But just one of the usual 10 or so members is Asian. In fact, it was just out of curiosity that the players learned a couple of tunes from a visiting Indian band, Shyam Brass Band.
We hadn't created ourselves to become a wedding brass band. We'd created ourselves to become a parade band.
Baritone sax player Mark Allen.
We're part of a company that organizes parades with young people. And then people saw us on these parades and said, why don't you come and play at our wedding? And we thought, oh, that's a nice idea. It was kind of surprising, really. We had become an Indian wedding brass band without really meaning to.
Bollywood Brass Band's latest CD, Movie Masala, highlights Bollywood classics. But there's a twist, a whole second album of remixes, including this one by Punjabi-British percussionist Bill Saunder. It's a new world when a bunch of English musicians can make their living playing South Asian weddings in London. For Studio 360, I'm Rob Weisberg.
You can find out more about Indian brass band music at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson. Did you ever wish a musician wrote you a rock and roll love letter?
Did you come to stay, or come to talk, or come to have me guess and guess what you're afraid to say?
Sometimes dreams do come true. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today we're celebrating this Partey weekend with some of our favorite music. Anytime Eric Clapton's Layla pops up on the radio, I start singing along or playing air guitar. I don't know anybody named Layla, but I always have had this mysterious feeling that Clapton was reading my mind. Maybe the number one attribute of a great pop song is that you, the listener, feel like you're really part of it. And maybe number two is that it's about a boy and a girl. Steve Nelson and Jocelyn Gonzalez share a few of the songs that were written for them.
You know, Mark was a friend.
Yeah, I know, he's been a good friend of mine.
A pretty good friend.
But lately something's changed, it ain't hard to define. Jesse's got himself a girl and I want to make her mine. And she's watching him with those eyes.
Rick Springfield was speaking to me. I was in high school. My best friend Mark was dating Sarah, and I wanted to make her mine.
You know I wish that I had Jesse's girl.
Those lyrics, those power chords, they went straight to the marrow of every bone in my body.
Where can I find a woman like that?
I have a long history of unrequited love. I also have a long history of identifying with unrequited love songs. I've dialed 8675309 many a time, so to speak. Okay, once I actually dialed it. No one answered. So it turns out that Jesse and his girl were actual people. Rick Springfield met them while he was taking a stained glass class. Jesse was really named Gary, but Rick says Gary's girl didn't exactly roll off the tongue. He also says he's forgotten the name of the woman. Yeah, right. Tell me, where can I find a woman like that? After a while, my friend Mark got dumped by Sarah. And get this, I eventually married her. Now that I had Jesse's girl, I decided to write my own song, of the requited kind. With apologies to Wyclef, the Bee Gees, and really anyone listening, here it is. The future's uncertain like the one Yoda said, but put your mind at ease and don't worry that pretty hat, cause through all of our trouble and all that jive, our love will keep staying alive. Let's keep it going. Thankfully, for the world of music, that was my first and last try at recording a song. From now on, when I want a love song for Sarah, I'll leave it to the pros, like Hall & Oates. It's you and me forever, Sarah's smile. Oh, won't you smile a while for me, Sarah?
My favorite song about a girl used to be... Sharona grew up to become a real estate agent, but here she is, immortalized as the hottest of all the young things. I wondered if I'd ever become the object of lust in such a song. I longed to become the muse of some tempestuous rock poet. What was the criteria for pop muse? I didn't think I had it. For one, the name. Jocelyn doesn't rhyme with anything. And I wasn't a fallen angel in gritty Paris. Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light. Nor was I a new wave nymph. Her name is Rio and she dances on the sand. So I resigned myself to reality, settling for drugstore Valentines instead of rock and roll love letters. After college, I found myself dating a popular local musician. He was a bit of a punk with a soft, quirky center. During our affair, I searched for hints that his feelings for me inhabited his music. Scratch that. Oh dear. Whatever motivated his art, it wasn't me. A year or so after we split, I went to see him perform in a spare acoustic setting. There was one number I'd never heard. It was simple, tender, sad. It stunned the small audience. As he came off stage, I asked him about that song. "Did you like it?" he asked. "Yes," I replied. "I loved it." "Well, a long time ago," he said, "I wrote it for you."
I don't read minds, but I can read a front page headline from across my room, where you look beautiful, about to say what we both know is true, that I'm so wrong for you. Don't take your coat off, don't take your coat off.
I know it's a crappy copy of the song. It's the only one that exists. But it's not the rarity that makes it a hit. It's just about a girl. And the girl is me.
And if you say you'll stay, all the blood would rush so quickly through my veins. All this might pass away. And you wouldn't stop to cry. Say you're out of time, or that you didn't come to stay. You came to say goodbye. So don't take your coat off. Don't take your coat off. Don't take your coat off, 'cause you might change your mind.
Jocelyn Gonzalez and Steve Nelson. One of the pleasures of working on this show is that we get to meet amazing musicians close up. Producer Ave Carrillo is devoted to the bassist and singer Michele Indigocello. But Michele is notorious for absolutely hating interviews. After years of trying, Ave was finally able to get her to sit down in the studio. She talked to her in 2005.
I really love the music of Michele Indigocello. There are other musicians I've been obsessed with, but there aren't any others whose albums I can sing note for note, horns, guitars, and bass lines from the start of the album to the end. Boom, da-da-da-da-da-da.
Sit back, relax, and listen to the 8-track. Dig it like an old soul record.
Plantation Lullabies was her debut album back in 1993, and it still sounds groundbreaking 12 years later. It's funky and beautiful with lyrics about love, but also it's about racism, drugs, and poverty.
Housing, birth control, and abortion. The capitalistic hand around my throat, shooting up dope just to cope, and it's dehumanizing society. We both found God when we obeyed.
Her second album, Peace Beyond Passion, is full of biblical imagery, exploring issues like homophobia.
Hey, fat, better run, 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 'cause daddy's home. Daddy's sweet little boy, just a little too sweet. And every night the man shall the faggot with a real man should be.
Clearly, the woman has a lot to say, and I've been wanting this interview to happen for so long. So I was almost shaking with excitement while waiting for it to start. And when she arrived at our studio, she slumped down in her chair, whipped out her BlackBerry, and started playing Tetris. So, we can actually hear the BlackBerry from the microphone.
Okay.
All right. What you gonna ask me?
His mother would pray.
Michele wasn't actually rude. She was just painfully shy. And clearly, she'd much rather be playing music than sitting in a studio talking to the media.
I've read that interviews are not exactly what you look forward to the most. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah. Why is that?
Where are you from?
I'm from the Bay Area.
What did your parents do for
a living? No, I understand what
you
mean.
Okay. Right. Yeah. I'm just not that deep. There's not much going on. I'm so simple. I like to eat. I like to walk. I wish I was, I guess, a more learned person or had some theory or concept. But, I got a high school education. Some days I sing, some days I don't. Some songs have words, some don't. Are we going to eat today?
As a bisexual, bass-playing, black, Muslim, female bandleader, she's had to learn to guard herself against prying. In addition, critics and fans have a hard time keeping up with her dramatic musical shifts. In 1999, the album Bitter was released, and the critical response was bitter. Sales were disappointing, too, compared to her previous records. The album is meditative, soaked in string arrangements, and the songs have titles like Faithful, Satisfy, Loyalty, and Bitter.
You push me away bitterly. My apologies fall on your deaf ears.
3 years later in 2002, she recalled the days of mixtapes with her album Cookie. It's a bit of a mishmash of all styles.
Total request now.
It's funny to me. It's like my art piece record to me. It's so funny because everyone's like, make a black record. And I'm like, I wake up every day and I'm black. What do you mean? And so it's got a lot of harshness in it. And I was like, I'm parroting the stuff I hear, because all it is about sex, what you wear, you know.
That's all right. Got a lot of sense running through your bones.
But then I realized when I was with some friends of mine who had beautiful children that I love, they can't play that record. Wow, it kind of felt a little strange.
But as Michelle would probably say, that's all in the past.
Past is never to return. It's meaningless.
It's actually not all that surprising then that Michelle's new album barely features her bass playing. She doesn't sing or rap on any songs. It's called Dance of the Infidel, and it's a jazz record. The album showcases legendary jazz musicians like Oliver Lake, Cassandra Wilson, and Don Byron. There is singing, but it's not Michelle.
And I observe hardly anyone takes notice of me.
There's all these great, amazing people who are 20 times more talented than I'll ever be. And so I realize what I'm doing is to go out so people can see them. Jazz is like, it's the ultimate lesson in faith. When you go see a pop act or an R&B act, because this has been a challenge for me too, you have a song to sort of hold on to. Even if you don't feel good that day, have cramps, you're tired, didn't have lunch, you have the lyric and the foundation of the song to get through. Okay, you have ABC, take the A, sing the chorus out, blah. With improvisational music, you don't know, and you could fall flat on your face. Or you could soar to amazing heights, and then you soar so high, and then you get afraid, and you know, then you're like Icarus, you know, and you're like, oh, I got too close to the sun.
Verve Records originally was going to release Dance the Infidel, but they were unhappy with how little presence Michelle had on the record. Instead of changing the music, she just changed labels.
I'm having an experience now where they want me to be the leader. And I'm like, I don't want to lead. You need a lot of confidence and a lot of arrogance. I think in my youth I had a lot more than I do now. I go to the shows and it just says my name, so it deflates me. And I don't think people understand why.
Successful female singers crowd popular music. It's not as common that women actually write the songs, are virtuosos on their instrument, produce their own albums, and direct their band.
I remember I had one rehearsal and I had a new drummer who actually became really good friends, but at first it was quite difficult because he told me, you know, a woman shouldn't be a leader. And I was like, good to meet you too. All right, the next tune is... This is how I want it played. <You know? laughs>
I have a theory that Michelle's music somehow reflects the many identities she carries, those she was born with and those she chose to adopt.
No matter where you are, you could be an infidel. Who you are, what you wear, how you dress, male or female, it doesn't matter. Muslims look at how I dress and I'm haram. You know, that's what the dance of the infidel is about. This is all judgments. Does that make any sense?
Your lips are like strands of scarlet. Your mouth is my...
For Studio 360, I'm Ave Carrillo.
Your neck's like the Tower of David. Shields mighty men. Your breasts are like fawns which feed among the lilies until the day. The sweet day breaks. Come by your soul to me. Come by your soul.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and you can find out more about Michele Ndegio Cello at studio360.org. Back in the early 1980s, bands like the Stray Cats started recycling the raucous, stripped-down sound of early 50s rock, their parents' music.
Black and orange Stray Cats sitting on a fence.
That was the so-called rockabilly revival. These days, rockabilly isn't top 10, but the Stray Cats leader, Brian Setzer, is still in love with the music. And you can hear that love on his recent album, Rockabilly Riot, which is a tribute to Sun Records. Sun was the studio in Nashville that introduced Elvis and Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison to the world. But when Setzer started digging through the vaults there, he found something he hadn't expected.
I literally sat down and listened to hundreds of Sun session songs, which was a nice thing to do. It wasn't really work. And I focused on the Sun catalog from 54 to 57. Those were the rockabilly years at Sun.
Get a rhythm. When you get the blues, come on, get a rhythm.
Then I tried to had to narrow that down to like a couple dozen songs. So I thought, well, if I give everybody two songs, no, you know, try not to make it more than, you know, two Johnny Cash songs, two Roy Orbison songs. I'd be in good shape. And then, as far as the songs went, I tried to choose. I had to do something like Blue Suede Shoes, the most popular rockabilly song ever. And then I wanted to get stuff that no one has ever heard before. I found a song called Peroxide Blonde in a Hopped Up Model Ford. Well, I've got a Peroxide Blonde and a Hopped Up Model Ford. My wife, you know, she goes, "That's me. I'm the Peroxide Blonde, and you've got the Model A Ford. You know, you got to cut this song." So I pretty much lived that song. That song is my life. And man, when that needle was about to hit the vinyl, I went, "Please be good," because that title was just killer.
Peroxide Blonde in a Hopped Up Model Ford.
And it kind of just faded in halfway through the song. And I thought, wow, this song's only 30 seconds long. And I realized, well, half the song is missing. So I said, you know, I think I got something's wrong with this record or something. I called up my friend who collects records. Do you have a version of this song, Peroxide Blonde? He sent me it, and it was the same thing. I went, man, this song's too good. I gotta get to the bottom of this.
Well, we took down Maine just to make a scene. I barked my tires as the light turned green. I slapped it through the floor and I let out on the clutch. And what was left on the road.
So we actually tracked down Gene Simmons, who originally played, not Gene Simmons from Kiss, of course. He probably, I don't know if he did a rockabilly album yet. The original Gene Simmons, who wrote Peroxide Blonde and a Hopped Up Model Ford. Well, we found him.
The first verse was clipped off, and so quite possibly what happened was in somewhere mixing down, and those old tapes get brittle, you know, and someone possibly broke the tape and didn't get it back together. When Brian called me and wanted me to dig up the first verse of it, I said, gosh, I don't even remember it. What the first verse was.
I said, well, do you have the other half? He goes, I can't remember it. And I said, you want to write the other half? He goes, no, you write it. He said to me, well, you know, man, it was so long ago. I was 18 years old when I wrote that.
I told him I didn't think I could get back in that mood and that time again. So I said, man, why don't you take a stab at it?
So I said, yeah, I'll give it a crack. I'll try and write the first couple verses and a new chorus.
And he came up with a heck of a verse. I mean, it fit right to the song.
Well, Gene drove up to Nashville, and he was just all happy, you know, just happy to hear his song. It's probably been 50 years, you know.
He said, well, come on in here. Said, we'll fix a start on your song, and maybe you can show the band how it goes and what have you. And we got to cutting up in the studio a little bit, and I got to singing some harmony with him, and he said, "Hey, man, get on that other mic."
And he just dropped everything and ran in and sang the harmony, like, you know, perfectly. You know, I don't think we had to do two takes. He just, you know, nailed it.
Dragon down pain once more with the peroxide bomb in the heart of a four.
Well, it was a great feeling because I felt sure that someone was going to pick up on some of it. And I felt like it was a matter of time to one of those songs, but I never dreamed it would be that one. And, of course, that song fit Brian so well. It was his kind of song, his kind of meats, so to speak, you know.
Think about it, killer.
You can find out more about Brian Setzer and Sun Records at studio360.org. Trey Kay produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson. In a minute, country star Willie Nelson tells us about the song that changed his life.
The melody has that universal appeal. Love that melody.
That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We have been on a wild musical expedition today, and on our last leg of the tour, we're going to introduce you to some unusual sounds. Like the ukulele, as you've never heard it before. Just don't call it the ukulele if you visit Hawaii.
Ukulele. That's the New Yorker's pronunciation of ukulele.
That's ukuleleist Herb Ota.
Uku in Hawaiian means flea, and lele meant to jump, so it's a jumping flea.
Ota has recorded more than 60 albums, including a recent collaboration with Lyle Ritz, another ukuleleist. They recorded it at a guitar shop in Santa Monica, California, and surprised more than a few members of the audience there.
They see two ukuleles, and they probably think, oh, is somebody going to sing? Or is somebody going to do the hula?
Or at least play Hawaiian music.
Yeah, Hawaiian music.
The reaction was astonishment that such kind of music could come from a little four-stringed instrument like that. As I understand it, you were doing that kind of music from the very beginning of your career.
Well, I think we all grew up with that type of music. It's that era, you know, in the 40s.
Yeah, but not many people were playing songs on it, jazz standards. You were and I was, and it's just interesting now. I ran into you at the Hyatt Waikiki one day. And I couldn't believe my ears when I heard it. Got my first uke in 1950, and that was before rock and roll, and the big bands were still in force. And a song that I picked up and played and loved was "Where or When," a Rodgers and Hart song, and I still play it. It's a good exercise on the uke, it's a good chord study. It just lays right, and it kind of flows over the fingerboard. It's not difficult, but it has a character about it that sparkles.
I had a school and I taught for 20 years, but not anymore. I don't think I have the stamina and the patience to teach anymore.
Well, Herb, you have instruction books out and a video.
Oh, you do too.
Yeah, well, yours is better than mine.
No, I think yours is better.
The uke is easy to carry around, and you can hold it. The tactile sensation you get is really neat, personal, intimate. It's friendly, and it's easy to, in just a few minutes, you can learn three chords and play songs with it.
And it's portable, and it's light, and you can take it to the beach with you. Not in New York, but in Hawaii.
Herb Ota and Lyle Ritz. Their CD is called Ukulele Jazz, Live at McCabe's. And Steve Nelson produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson. Jazz on the ukulele, as I will continue to say, might seem a little odd, but you want to bet we can find stranger? In the late 1960s, reggae producers in Jamaica invented dub. They'd take the bass line and drum track from two different songs, then add heavy reverb and delay effects. That's dub. Musicians all over the globe have gotten into making dub remixes, like Robert Cummings, a Canadian drummer who lived in Berlin for a decade. He formed a band that applies dub ideas to folk music from the Bavarian Alps, called, obviously, Alpendub.
Alpine music was something that, for me, is it's a new territory to be discovered. I would say a musical adventure. Saving Alpine music, if that comes out as a byproduct, it'll be amusing.
I say to my parents, I want yodeling. And in my home village, there was a woman, they teach yodeling, and I go to her and start yodeling. Yo ho 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 dee, like that. Yo ho 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 dee.
No one really knows what dub music really is, except for the dub reggae purists, of course, have got their definitions. Basically, for me, it stands for an openness towards taking whatever sound you've got and transforming it in whatever way you want to. For dub music, the important thing is that the structure of the music can't be too complicated. It's more about the way you carry the sounds. It's not about performing a huge score or something.
I like to yodel more the traditional way. It's like a call. Oh yeah, like that way. But I love the American yodeling. It's you have this yodelay.
What Americans always say is that, why do Germans always clap on the one?
Yeah, right. Right.
And it's like, this is a little bit strange to bring in the offbeat. But in poker, it's the same.
In poker, it's in there.
So it's, you have that offbeat always in poker, but in the slow dances, you don't really have that offbeat. But it fits in.
For me, you have ways of making you play German music.
No, for me it's not German. No, it's like a mixture of German and American. That's the way it feels to me. I have more visions of like old hillbilly sitting at home on the porch, one playing a fiddle, and that have come from all over the world, brought their culture with them, and it's kind of melted together.
It's nothing better about it to have like pictures to hear music, and you have a certain picture of Alps and cows and Rasta men.
Alpendub's latest record is called Yodelay. That's spelled J-O-D-E-L-A-Y if you're looking. You can find out more about it at studio360.org. We have been all over the world today on our musical journey, but we're going to end up in Abbott, Texas, the little town where Willie Nelson grew up. Today, Willie shares with us the story of how one heavenly tune drifting through his front door as a boy got under his skin for good.
In Abbott, there were four churches, and I lived within 100 yards of three of them, and there was a tabernacle that was just as closest from this where we're sitting to right out there, where every summer I could sit there and hear every denomination in town come do their revival meetings, where they would come and sing gospel and the guy would preach every night. So I got preached to in every denomination every summer. And so I grew up in all that kind of stuff, and it was really great. On Sunday, there would be early morning Sunday, and then at noon, sometimes we'd have all-day singing dinner on the ground type thing. So it was all-day church on Sunday, and then Monday night, I think, was prayer meeting night. Wednesday was visitation, where you go around and visit people and try to get them to come to church, and then next thing you know, it's Sunday again. So the whole week was pretty much spent in church.
No wonder we like to sing sometimes, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me."
A preacher up there in Abbott, he used to tell me that the first song that he ever remembered me singing, and that was when I had to have been 6-7 years old, was "Amazing Grace." I really don't know how and why I started singing. I love the song, and I would sing it every night because I just enjoy singing it, and the people enjoy hearing it, and I let them sing, and they enjoy singing, you know, get loud and sing it, and there's something good about it. I'm sure it's a combination of all the things, saying the words, feeling the music, the melody has that universal appeal. Love that melody. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. Well, when I started traveling, usually I played Saturday nights. There's no way to get up and find a church. I really believe that we walk around in our church every day anyway. It's not a building. You don't really have to go to the same one every Sunday morning.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound.
Honestly, I think I sing it because it feels good to sing it, and the audience likes to sing too. The fact that it's a religious song is just kind of secondary, I think. But that song is just one of those magic songs that once you don't have to be a Christian, you don't have to be anything to like that song.
And grace my fears really.
Willie Nelson, KUT's Michael May, produced our story.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks very much for listening to Studio 360 today. I hope you'll join us for next week's show, and for that matter, for every week's show through 2008. Here's to not hearing White Christmas and Auld Lang Syne for 11 months. Best wishes from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, which produce our show, and from our entire production team.
Julie Burstein.
Lital Malad.
David Krasnow.
Michelle Siegel.
Derek John.
Jenny Lawton.
Pike Medinowski.
Sarah Lilly.
Rob Weisberg.
Carrie Hillman.
Abe Carrillo.
Eric Malinsky.
Kevin Ryan.
Jillian Goodman.
Ben Conniff.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, and SCG, whose charitable resources support FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, online at fjc.org, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
The art of writing a jingle.
I don't want to grow up on Toys R Us.
Inside every 60-year-old person sipping tea is a 6-year-old slurping ice cream. And you have to keep that in your head when you're writing a jingle.
The culture of advertising. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to PRI's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org.